Nell had a pretty good idea what to do with the chain. Starting with the end, she examined the toggles and began to mark their positions down. The primer always gave her scratch pages when she needed them. She made a horizontal mark for toggles parallel to the chain and a vertical mark for those that were perpendicular. She came up with 8 vertical marks followed by a horizontal mark, then 5 vertical marks followed by a horizontal mark, 12 vertical marks followed by a horizontal, 12 vertical marks again followed by a horizontal, 15 vertical marks followed by 2 horizontal, 9 vertical marks followed again by 2 horizontal, 1 vertical mark, 1 horizontal, 13 vertical marks, then 3 horizontal, 4 vertical marks, 1 horizontal, 21 vertical marks, 1 horizontal, 11 vertical marks, 1 horizontal, 5 vertical marks, 5 horizontal, 20 vertical marks, 1 horizontal, 21 vertical marks, 1 horizontal, 18 vertical, 1 horizontal, 9 vertical, 1 horizontal, 14 vertical, 1 horizontal, 7 vertical, and finally, 1 horizontal. If she counted the vertical marks and replaced them with numbers, this amounted to 8-5-12-12-15-9-1-13-4-21-11-5-20-18-9-14-7-. And if the numbers stood for letters of the alphabet, horizontal marks divided the letters, and double horizontals were spaces, this was, "Hello, I am Duke Turing. Perhaps the multiple horizontals were codes for commonly used words. --- could mean the. --, not used, could possibly be a or an. --- could mean of. If that was right, then the message was, "Hello, I am the Duke of Turing," which was interesting, since the giant fellow in the armor had previously identified himself as such, and she deemed it unlikely that he would be sending her a message by this route. This must have come from someone else calling himself the Duke of Turing, perhaps a real, living human being. A few years ago, Nell could have relied on it, but in recent years, the primer had become much subtler than it used to be, full of hidden traps, and she could no longer make comfortable and easy assumptions. It was just as likely that this chain had descended straight from the throne room itself, and that the mechanical Duke was, for some unfathomable reason, trying to dupe her. So while she was happy to respond to this message in kind, she intended to take a guarded approach until she had established whether the sender was human or mechanical. The next part of the message was, "Give, 3 dashes, chain, 4 dashes, tug, 6 dashes, answer." Assuming that 4 horizontal marks stood for A or An, and 6 stood for 2, this was, "Give the chain a tug to answer." Nell began to flip the toggles on the chain, erasing the message from this personage calling himself the Duke, and replacing it with, "I am Princess Nell. Why did you imprison me?" Then she gave the chain a tug, and after a moment, it began to withdraw from her cell. A few minutes later, back came the message. "Welcome, Princess Nell. Let us devise a more efficient means of communication." Followed by instructions on how to use a more compact system of toggles to represent numbers, and how to convert the numbers into letters and punctuation marks. Once this was settled, the Duke said, "I am the real Duke. I created these machines, and they imprisoned me in a high tower far above you. The machine calling himself the Duke is merely the largest and most sophisticated of my creations." Nell responded, This chain weighs hundreds of pounds. You must be strong for a human.
The Duke responded, You are a sharp one, Princess Nell. The full weight of the chain is actually several thousand pounds, and I manage it by means of a winch located in my room and deriving its motive power from the central shaft.
Night had long since fallen on the meadow. Nell closed the primer, packed up her basket, and returned home. She stayed up late into the night with the primer, just as she had when she was a small child, and as a result was late for church the next morning. They said a special prayer for Miss Matheson, who was at home and said to be feeling poorly. Nell called on her for a few minutes after the service, then went straight back home and dove into the primer again. She was attacking two problems at once. First, she needed to figure out how the lock on the door worked. Second, she needed to find out whether the person sending her the message was human or mechanical. If she could be confident that he was a human, she could ask him for assistance in opening the lock. But until she had settled this issue, she had to keep her activities a secret. The lock only had a few parts that she could observe. The crank, the bolt, and a pair of brass drums set into the top with digits from 0 to 9 engraved in them, so that by spinning different ways, they could display all the integers from 00 to 99. These drums were in almost constant motion whenever the crank was turning. Nell had managed to detach several yards of chain from the one that she was using to converse with the Duke, and so she was able to feed different messages into the lock and see what result they had. The number on the top changed with every link that went into the machine, and it seemed to determine, in a limited way, what the machine would do next. For example, she had learned that the number happened to be 09, and if the next link in the chain was in the vertical position, which the Duke referred to as a 1, the drums would spin around and change the number to 23. But if the next link was, instead, a 0, as the Duke referred to links with horizontal toggles, the number drums would change to 03. But that wasn't all. In this case, the machine would, for some reason, reverse the direction in which the chain was moving through the machine, and also flick the toggle from 0 to 1. That is, the machine could write on the chain as well as read from it. From idle chit-chat with the Duke, she learned that the numbers on the drums were referred to as states. At first she did not know which states led to other states, and so she wandered aimlessly from one state to the next, recording the connections on scratch paper. This soon grew to a table listing some 32 different states and how the lock would respond to a 1 or a 0 when it was in each of those states. It took a while for Nell to fill out all the blank spaces in the table because some of the states were hard to get to. They could be reached only by getting the machine to write a certain series of 1s and 0s on the chain. She would have gone crazy with 1s and 0s were it not for the frequent interruptions from the Duke, who evidently had nothing better to do than send her messages. These two parallel courses of inquiry occupied all of Nell's free time for a couple of weeks, and she made slow but steady progress.
"You must learn how to operate the lock on your door," the Duke said. "This will enable you to effect an escape and to come and rescue me. I will instruct you." All he wanted to talk about was technology, which wouldn't help Nell in figuring out whether he was a human or a machine.
"Why don't you pick your own lock?" she responded, "and come and rescue me. I am just a poor, helpless young thing, all alone in the world, and so scared and lonely. And you seem so brave and heroic. Your story really is quite romantic, and I cannot wait to see how it all comes out now that our fates have become intertwined."
"The machines placed a special lock on my door, not a Turing machine," responded the Duke.
"Describe yourself," Nell wrote.
"Nothing special, I'm afraid," wrote the Duke. "How about yourself?"
"Slightly taller than average, flashing green eyes, raven hair falling in luxuriant waves to my waist, unless I pin it up to emphasize my high cheekbones and full lips. Narrow waist, pert breasts, long legs, alabaster skin that flushes vividly when I am passionate about something, which is frequently.
Your description is reminiscent of my late wife, God rest her soul.
Tell me about your wife.
The subject fills me with such unutterable sadness that I cannot bear to write about it. Now, Let's buckle down to work on the Turing machine. Since the prurient approach had dead-ended, Nell tried a different tack, playing stupid. Sooner or later, the Duke would become a little testy, but he was always terribly patient with her, even after the 20th repetition of, "Could you explain it again with different words? I still don't get it." Of course, for all she knew, he was upstairs punching the walls until his knuckles were bloody and simply pretending to be patient with her. A man who'd been locked up in a tower for years would learn to be extremely patient. She tried sending him poetry. He sent back glowing reviews but declined to send her any of his own, saying it wasn't good enough to be committed to metal. On her 20th day in the dungeon, Princess Nell finally got the lock open. Rather than making an immediate escape, she locked herself back in and sat down to ponder her next move. If the Duke was human, she should notify him so that they could plan their escape. If he was a machine, doing so would lead to disaster. She had to figure out the Duke's identity before she made another move. She sent him another poem. For the Greek's love, she gave away her heart, her father, crown, and homeland. They stopped to rest on Naxos. She woke up alone upon the strand, the sails of her lover's ship descending round the slow curve of the earth. Ariadne fell into a swoon on the churned sand and dreamed of home. Minos did not forgive her, and holding diamonds in the pouches of his eyes, had her flung into the labyrinth. She was alone this time. Through a wilderness of blackness wandered Ariadne many days, until she tripped on the memory. It was still wound all through the place. She spun it round her fingers, lifted it from the floor, knotted it into lace, erased it. The lace made a gift for him who had imprisoned her. Blind with tears, he read it with his fingers and opened his arms. The answer came back much too quickly, and it was the same answer as always. "I do so envy your skill with words. Now, if you do not object, let us turn our attention to the inner workings of the Turing machine." She had made it as obvious as she dared, and the Duke still hadn't gotten the message. He must be a machine. Why the deception? Clearly, the mechanical Duke desired for her to learn about the Turing machines. That is, if a machine could ever be said to desire something. There must be something wrong with the Duke's programming. He knew there was something wrong with it, and he needed a human to fix it. Once Nell had figured these things out, the rest of the Castle Turing story resolved itself quickly and neatly. She slipped out of her cell and stealthily explored the castle. The soldiers rarely noticed her, and when they did, they could not improvise. They had to go back to the Duke to be reprogrammed. Eventually, Princess Nell found her way into a room beneath the windmill that contained a sort of clutch mechanism. By disengaging the clutch, she was able to stop the shaft. Within a few hours, the springs inside the soldier's back had all run down, and they had all stopped in their tracks. The whole castle was frozen, as if she had cast an enchantment over it. Now roaming freely, she opened up the Duke's throne and found a Turing machine beneath it. On either side of the machine was a narrow hole descending straight through the floor and into the earth for as far as her torchlight could illuminate it. The chain containing the Duke's program dangled on either side into these holes. Nell tried throwing stones into the holes and never heard them hit bottom. The chain must be unfathomably long. High up, in one of the castle's towers, Princess Nell found a skeleton in a chair, slumped over a table piled high with books. Mice, bugs, and birds had nibbled away all of the flesh, but traces of gray hair and whiskers were still scattered around the table, and around the cervical vertebrae was a golden chain bearing a seal with the T insignia. She spent some time going through the Duke's books. Most of them were notebooks where he would sketch the inventions he hadn't had time to build yet. He had plans for whole armies of Turing machines made to run in parallel, and for chains with links that could be set in more than two positions, and for machines that would read and write on two-dimensional sheets of chainmail instead of one-dimensional chains,
and for a three-dimensional Turing grid a mile on a side through which a mobile Turing machine would climb about, computing as it went. No matter how complicated his designs became, the Duke always found a way to simulate their behavior by putting a sufficiently long chain into one of the traditional Turing machines. That is to say, that while the parallel and multidimensional machines worked more quickly than the original model, they didn't really do anything different. One afternoon, Nell was sitting in her favorite meadow reading about these things in the primer when a riderless chevaline emerged from the woods and galloped directly toward her. This was not highly unusual in and of itself. Chevalines were smart enough to be sent out in search of specific persons. People rarely sent them in search of Nell, though. The chevaline galloped at her full tilt until it was just a few feet away, and then it planted its hooves and stopped instantly, a trick it could easily do when it wasn't carrying a human. It was carrying a note written in Miss Stricken's hand. "Nell, please come immediately. Miss Matheson has requested your presence, and time is short." Nell didn't hesitate. She gathered her things, stuffed them into the mount's small luggage compartment, and climbed on. "Go," she said. Then, getting herself well situated and clenching the hand grip, she added, "Unlimited speed." Within moments, the chevaline was threading gaps between trees at something close to a cheetah's sprint velocity, clawing its way up the hill toward the dog pod grid. From the way the tubes ran, Nell guessed that Miss Matheson was plugged into the feed in two or three different ways, though everything had been discreetly hidden under many afghans, piled up on top of her body like the airy layers of a French pastry. Only her face and hands were visible, and looking at them, Nell remembered for the first time since their introduction just how old Miss Matheson was. The force of her personality had blinded Nell and all the girls to the blunt evidence of her true age. "Please let us be, Miss Stricken," Miss Matheson said, and Miss Stricken backed out warily, strewing reluctant and reproving glances along her trail. Nell sat on the edge of the bed and carefully lifted one of Miss Matheson's hands from the coverlet, as if it were the desiccated leaf of some rare tree. "Nell," Miss Matheson said, "do not waste my few remaining moments with pleasantries." "Oh, Miss Matheson," Nell began, but the old lady's eyes widened, and she gave Nell a certain look, practiced through many decades in the classroom, that still had not lost its power to silence. "I have requested that you come here because you are my favorite student." "No, do not say a word," Miss Matheson admonished her, as Nell leaned her face closer, eyes filling with tears. "Teachers are not supposed to have favorites. But I am approaching that time when I must confess all my sins, so there it is. I know that you have a secret, Nell, though I cannot imagine what it is. And I know that your secret has made you different from any other girl I have ever taught. I wonder what you suppose you will do with your life when you leave this academy, as you must soon, and go out into the world. Take the oath, of course, as soon as I reach the age of eligibility. And I suppose that I should like to study the art of programming and how reactives are made. Some day, of course, after I have become one of Her Majesty's subjects, I should like to find a nice husband and perhaps raise children." "Oh, stop it," Miss Matheson said. "You are a young woman. Of course you think about whether you shall have children. Every young woman does. I haven't much time left, Nell, and we must dispense with what makes you like all the other girls and concentrate on what makes you different." At this point, the old lady gripped Nell's hand with surprising force and raised her head just a bit off the pillow. The tremendous wrinkles and furrows on her brow deepened, and her hooded eyes took on an intense, burning appearance. "Your destiny is marked in some way, Nell. I have known it since the day Lord Finkel McGraw came to me and asked me to admit you, a ragged little feet girl, into my academy. You can try to act the same. We have tried to make you the same. You can pretend it in the future if you insist, and you can even take the oath. But it's all a lie. You are different." These words struck Nell like a sudden cold wind of pure mountain air and stripped away the soporific cloud of sentimentality. Now she stood exposed and utterly vulnerable, but not unpleasantly so.
"Are you suggesting that I leave the bosom of the adopted tribe that has nurtured me?"
"I am suggesting that you are one of those rare people who transcends tribes, and you certainly don't need a bosom anymore," Miss Matheson said. "You will find, in time, that this tribe is as good as any other. Better than most, really."
Miss Matheson exhaled deeply and seemed to dissolve into her blankets.
"Now, I haven't long, so give us a kiss, and then be on your way, girl."
Nell leaned forward and pressed her lips against Miss Matheson's cheek, which looked leathery but was surprisingly soft. Then, unwilling to leave so abruptly, she turned her head and rested it on Miss Matheson's chest for a few moments. Miss Matheson stroked feebly at her hair and tut-tutted.
"Farewell, Miss Matheson," Nell said. "I will never forget you."
"Nor I you," Miss Matheson whispered. "Though admittedly, that is not saying much."
A very large chevaline stood stolidly in front of Constable Moore's house, somewhere between a percheron and a small elephant in size and bulk. It was the dirtiest object Nell had ever seen in her life. Its encrustations alone must have weighed hundreds of pounds and were redolent with the scent of night soil and stagnant water. A fragment of a mulberry branch, still bearing leaves and even a couple of actual berries, had gotten wedged into a flexing joint between two adjoining armor plates, and long ropes of milfoil trailed from its ankles. The constable was sitting in the middle of his bamboo grove, enveloped in a suit of hoplite armor, similarly filthy and scarred, that was twice as big as he was, and that made his bare head look absurdly small. He had ripped the helmet off and dropped it into his fish pond, where it floated around like the eviscerated hull of a scuttled dreadnought. He looked very gaunt, and was staring vacantly, without blinking, at some kudzu that was slowly but inexorably conquering the wisteria. As soon as Nell saw the look on his face, she made him some tea and brought it to him. The constable reached for the tiny alabaster teacup with armored hands that could have crumbled stones like loaves of stale bread. The thick barrels of the guns built into the arms of his suit were scorched on the inside. He plucked the cup from Nell's hands with the precision of a surgical robot, but did not lift it to his lips, perhaps afraid that he might, in his exhaustion, get the distance a bit wrong and inadvertently crush the porcelain into his jaw, or even decapitate himself. Merely holding the cup, watching the steam rise from its surface, seemed to calm him. His nostrils dilated once, then again.
"Darjeeling," he said. "Well chosen. Always thought of India as a more civilized place than China. Have to throw out all of the oolong now, all the Kimun, the Lungjiang, the Lapsang Souchong. Time to switch over to Ceylon, Pico, Assam," he chuckled.
White trails of dried salt ran back from the corners of the constable's eyes and disappeared into his hairline. He had been riding fast with his helmet off. Nell wished that she'd been able to see the constable thundering across China on his war chevaline.
"I've retired for the last time," he explained. He nodded in the direction of China. "Been doing a bit of consulting work for a gentleman there. Complicated fellow. Dead now. Had many facets, but now he'll go down in history as just another damn Chinese warlord who didn't make the grade."
"It is remarkable, love," he said, looking at Nell for the first time, "how much money you can make shoveling back the tide. In the end, you need to get out while the getting is good. Not very honorable, I suppose, but then, there is no honor among consultants."
Nell did not imagine that Constable Moore wanted to get into a detailed discussion of recent events, so she changed the subject.
"I think I've finally worked out what you were trying to tell me years ago about being intelligent," she said.
The constable brightened all at once.
"Pleased to hear it."
"The Vickies have an elaborate code of morals and conduct.
It grew out of the moral squalor of an earlier generation, just as the original Victorians were preceded by the Georgians and the Regency. The old guard believe in that code because they came to it the hard way. They raise their children to believe in that code. But their children believe it for entirely different reasons.
They believe it, the constable said, because they have been indoctrinated to believe it.
Yes. Some of them never challenge it. They grow up to be small-minded people who can tell you what they believe, but not why they believe it. Others become disillusioned by the hypocrisy of the society and rebel, as did Elizabeth Finkel McGraw.
Which path do you intend to take, Nell?
Said the constable, sounding very interested.
Conformity or rebellion?
Neither one. Both ways are simple-minded. They are only for people who cannot cope with contradiction and ambiguity.
Ah! Excellent, the constable exclaimed.
As punctuation, he slapped the ground with his free hand, sending up a shower of sparks and transmitting a powerful shock through the ground to Nell's feet. I suspect that Lord Finkel McGraw, being an intelligent man, sees through all of the hypocrisy in his society, but upholds its principles anyway, because that is what is best in the long run. And I suspect that he has been worrying about how best to inculcate this stance in young people who cannot understand, as he does, its historical antecedents, which might explain why he has taken an interest in me. The primer may have been Finkel McGraw's idea to begin with, a first attempt to go about this systematically.
The Duke plays his cards close, Constable Moore said, and so I cannot say whether your suppositions are correct. But I will admit it hangs together nicely.
Thank you.
What do you intend to do with yourself now that you have pieced all of this together? A few more years' education and polishing will place you in a position to take the oath.
I am, of course, aware that I have favorable prospects in the Atlantan file, Nell said. But I do not think that it would be fitting for me to take the straight and narrow path. I am going to China now to seek my fortune.
Well, Constable Moore said, look out for the fists.
His gaze wandered over his battered and filthy armor and came to rest on the floating helmet.
They are coming now.
The best explorers, like Burton, made every effort to blend in. In this spirit, Nell stopped at a public MC, doffed her long dress, and compiled a new set of clothes. A navy blue skin-tight coverall emblazoned with "Shit Happens" in pulsating orange letters. She swapped her old clothes for a pair of powered skates on the waterfront, and then headed straight for the causeway. It rose gently into the air for a few miles, and then the Pudong Economic Zone came into view at her feet, and Shanghai beyond that. And she suddenly began to pick up speed and had to cut the skate's power assist. She'd passed over the watershed now. Nell was alone in China.
The Hackworths have a family reunion. Hackworth strikes out on his quest. An unexpected companion.
Atlanta, Seattle was designed small and to the point. The narrow, convoluted straits of Puget Sound, already so full of natural islands, did not leave much room for artificial ones. So they had made it rather long and slender, parallel to the currents and the shipping lanes, and been rather stingy when it came to the parks, meadows, heaths, gentleman farms, and country estates. Much of the Seattle area was still sufficiently rich, civilized, and polite that New Atlantans did not object to living there. And little Victorian miniclaves were scattered about the place, particularly east of the lake, around the misty forest domains of the software cons. Gwen and Fiona had taken a townhouse in one of these areas. These tiny bits of New Atlantis stood out from the surrounding forest in the same way that a vicar in morning coat and wing collar would have in the Cave of the Drummers. The prevailing architecture here, among those who had not adopted Neo-Victorian precepts, was distinctly subterranean, as if these people were somehow ashamed of their own humanity and could not bear to fell even a handful of the immense Douglas firs that marched monotonously up the tumbling slopes toward the frozen, sodden ridge of the Cascades. Even when it was half buried, a house wasn't even a proper house. It was an association of modules, scattered about here and there and connected by breezeways or tunnels. Stuck together properly and built on a rise, these modules might have added up to a house of substance, even grandeur. But to Hackworth, riding through the territory on his way to visit his family, it was all depressing and confusing. 10 years among the drummers had not affected his Neo-Victorian aesthetics. He could not tell where one house left off and the next one began. The houses were all intertangled with one another like neurons in the brain. His mind's eye again seemed to seize control of his visual cortex. He could not see the firs anymore, just axons and dendrites hanging in black three-dimensional space, packets of rod logic maneuvering among them like space probes, meeting and copulating among the nerve fibers. It was a bit too aggressive to be a reverie and too abstract to be an hallucination. It didn't really clear away until a gust of cold mist hit him in his face. He opened his eyes and realized the kidnapper had stopped after emerging from the trees at the crest of a mossy ridgeline. Below him was a rocky bowl with a few cobblestone streets sketched out in a grid, a green park lined with red geraniums, a church with a white steeple, whitewashed four-story Georgian buildings surrounded by black wrought-iron fences. The security grid was tenuous and feeble. The software cons were at least as good at that kind of thing as Her Majesty's specialists, and so a New Atlantis clave in this area could rely on the neighbors to shoulder much of that burden. Kidnapper picked its way carefully down the steep declivity as Hackworth looked out over the tiny clave, musing at how familiar it seemed. Since leaving the drummers, he hadn't gone more than 10 minutes without being seized by a feeling of déjà vu, and now it was especially strong. Perhaps this was because, to some degree, all New Atlantis settlements looked alike. But he suspected that he had seen this place somehow in his communications with Fiona over the years. A bell clanged once or twice, and teenaged girls dressed in plaid uniform skirts began to emerge from a domed school. Hackworth knew that it was Fiona's school, and that she was not entirely happy there. After the crush of girls had gone out of the place, he rode Kidnapper into the schoolyard and sauntered once around the building, gazing in the windows. Without much trouble, he saw his daughter, sitting at a table in the library, hunched over a book, evidently as part of some disciplinary action. He wanted so badly to go in and put his arms around her, because he knew that she had spent many hours suffering like punishments, and that she was a lonely girl. But he was in New Atlantis, and there were proprieties to be observed. First things first. Gwendolyn's townhouse was only a few blocks away. Hackworth rang the bell, determined to observe all of the formalities now that he was a stranger in the house.
"May I ask what your visit is regarding?"
asked the parlor maid, as Hackworth spun his card onto the salver. Hackworth didn't like this woman, who was named Amelia, because Fiona didn't like her. And Fiona didn't like her because Gwen had given her some disciplinary authority in the household, and Amelia was the sort who relished having it. He tried not to confuse himself by wondering how he could possibly know all of these things. "Business," Hackworth said pleasantly. "Family business." Amelia was halfway up the stairs when her eyes finally focused on Hackworth's card. She nearly dropped the salver and had to clutch at the banister with one hand in order to keep her balance. She froze there for a few moments, trying to resist the temptation to turn around, and finally surrendered to it. The expression on her face was one of perfect loathing mixed with fascination. "Please carry out your duties," Hackworth said, "and dispense with the vulgar theatrics." Amelia, looking crestfallen, stormed up the stairs with the tainted card. There followed a good deal of muffled commotion upstairs. After a few minutes, Amelia ventured as far down as the landing and encouraged Hackworth to make himself comfortable in the parlor. He did so, noting that in his absence, Gwendolyn had been able to consummate all of the long-term furniture-buying strategies she had spent so much time plotting during the early years of their marriage. Wives and widows of secret agents in protocol enforcement could rely on being well cared for, and Gwen had not allowed his salary to sit around collecting dust. His ex-wife descended the stairway cautiously, stood outside the beveled glass parlor doors for a minute, peering at him through the gauze curtains, and finally slipped into the room without meeting his gaze and took a seat rather far away from him.
"Hello, Mr. Hackworth," she said.
"Mrs. Hackworth? Or is it back to Miss Lloyd?"
It is.
Ah, that's hard. When Hackworth heard the name Miss Lloyd, he thought of their courtship. They sat there for a minute or so, not saying anything, just listening to the ponderous ratcheting of the grandfather clock.
All right, Hackworth said. I won't trouble you talking about extenuating circumstances, as I don't ask for your forgiveness, and in all honesty, I'm not sure that I deserve it.
Thank you for that consideration.
I would like you to know, Miss Lloyd, that I am sympathetic to the step you have taken in securing a divorce, and harbor no bitterness on that account.
That is reassuring to know.
You should also know that whatever behavior I engaged in, as inexcusable as it was not motivated by rejection of you or of our marriage. It was not, in fact, a reflection upon you at all, but rather a reflection upon myself.
Thank you for clarifying that point.
I realize that any hope I might harbor in my breast of rekindling our former relationship, sincere as it might be, is futile, and so I will not trouble you after today.
I cannot tell you how relieved I am to hear that you understand the situation so completely.
However, I would like to be of service to you and Fiona in helping to resolve any loose ends.
You are very kind. I shall give you my lawyer's card.
And of course, I look forward to re-establishing some sort of contact with my daughter.
The conversation, which had been running as smoothly as a machine to this point, now veered off track and crashed. Gwendolyn reddened and stiffened.
You bastard.
The front door opened. Fiona stepped into the foyer carrying her schoolbooks. Amelia was there immediately, maneuvering around with her back to the foyer doors, blocking Fiona's view, talking to her in low, angry tones. Hackworth heard his daughter's voice. It was a lovely voice, a husky alto, and he would have recognized it anywhere.
"Don't lie to me. I recognized his Cheveline," she said, and finally shouldered Amelia out of the way, burst into the parlor, all lanky and awkward and beautiful, an incarnation of joy.
She took two steps across the oriental rug, and then launched herself full length across the settee into her father's arms, where she lay for some minutes, alternately weeping and laughing. Gwen had to be escorted from the room by Amelia, who came back immediately and stationed herself nearby, hands clasped behind back like a military sentry, observing Hackworth's every move. Hackworth couldn't imagine what they suspected he might be capable of. Incest in the parlor? But there was no point in spoiling the moment by thinking of galling things, and so he shut Amelia out of his mind. Father and daughter were allowed to converse for a quarter of an hour, really just queuing up subjects for future conversation. By that time, Gwen had recovered her composure enough to re-enter the room, and she and Amelia stood shoulder to shoulder, quivering in sympathetic resonance, until Gwen interrupted. "Fiona, your father and I were in the midst of a very serious discussion when you burst in on us. Please leave us alone for a few minutes." Fiona did, reluctantly. Gwen resumed her former position, and Amelia backed out of the room. Hackworth noticed that Gwen had fetched some documents bound up in red tape. "These are papers setting out the terms of our divorce, including all conditions relating to Fiona," she said. "You are already in violation, I'm afraid. Of course, this can be forgiven, as your lack of a forwarding address as such made it impossible for us to acquaint you with this information. Needless to say, it is imperative for you to familiarize yourself with these documents before darkening my door again."
"Naturally," Hackworth said. "Thank you for retaining them for me."
"If you will be so good as to withdraw from these premises, of course."
"Good day," Hackworth said, took the roll of papers from Gwen's trembling hand, and let himself out briskly. He was a bit surprised when he heard Amelia calling to him from the doorway.
"Mr. Hackworth, Miss Lloyd wishes to know whether you have established a new residence, so that your personal effects may be forwarded."
"None as yet," Hackworth said. "I'm in transit."
Amelia brightened.
"In transit to where?"
"Oh, I don't really know," Hackworth said.
A movement caught his eye, and he saw Fiona framed in a second-story window. She was undoing the latches, raising the sash.
"I'm on a quest of sorts."
"A quest for what, Mr. Hackworth?"
"Can't say precisely. You know, top secret and all that. Something to do with an alchemist. Who knows? Maybe there'll be fairies and hobgoblins, too, before it's all over. I'll be happy to fill you in when I return. Until then, please ask Miss Lloyd if she would be so understanding
as to retain those personal effects for just a bit longer. It can't possibly take more than another 10 years or so. And with that, Hackworth prodded Kidnapper forward, moving at an extremely deliberate pace. Fiona was on a velocipede with smart wheels that made short work of the cobblestone road. She caught up with her father just short of the security grid. Mother and Amelia had just materialized a block behind them in a half-lane car, and the sudden sensation of danger inspired Fiona to make an impetuous dive from the saddle of her velocipede onto Kidnapper's hindquarters, like a cowboy in a movie switching horses in mid-gallop. Her skirts, poorly adapted to cowboy maneuvers, got all fouled up around her legs, and she ended up slung over Kidnapper's back like a sack of beans, one hand clutching the vestigial knob where its tail would have been if it were a horse, and the other arm thrown around her father's waist. "I love you, Mother!" she shouted as they rode through the grid and out of the jurisdiction of New Atlantis family law. "Can't say the same for you, Amelia, but I'll be back soon. Don't worry about me. Goodbye!" And then the ferns and mist closed behind them, and they were alone in the deep forest. Carl Hollywood takes the oath. Stroll along the Thames. An encounter with Lord Finkel McGraw. Carl took the oath at Westminster Abbey on a surprisingly balmy day in April, and afterward went for a stride down the river, heading not too directly toward a reception that had been arranged in his honor at the Hopkins Theatre near Leicester Square. Even without a pedimotive, he walked as fast as many people jogged. Ever since his first visit to London as a malnourished theater student, he had preferred walking to any other way of getting around the place. Walking, especially along the embankment where fellow pedestrians were relatively few, also gave him freedom to smoke big, old, authentic cigars or the occasional briar pipe. Just because he was Victorian didn't mean he had to give up his peculiarities. Quite the opposite, in fact. Cruising along past old shrapnel-pocked Cleopatra's Needle in a comet-like corona of his own roiling, viscous smoke, he thought that he might get to like this. A gentleman in a top hat was standing on the railing, gazing stolidly across the water, and as Carl drew closer, he could see that it was Lord Alexander Chungsik Finkel McGraw, who, a day or two earlier, had stated during a cinephone conversation that he would like to meet him face-to-face in the near future for a chat. Carl Hollywood, remembering his new tribal affiliation, went so far as to doff his hat and bow. Finkel McGraw acknowledged the greeting somewhat distractedly.
"Please accept my sincere congratulations, Mr. Hollywood. Welcome to the file."
"Thank you.
I regret that I have not been able to attend any of your productions at the Hopkins. My friends who have could hardly have been more complimentary."
"Your friends are too kind," said Carl Hollywood.
He was still a little unsure of the etiquette. To accept the compliment at face value would have been boastful. To imply that his grace's friends were incompetent judges of theater was not much of an improvement. He settled for the less dangerous accusation that these friends had a superfluity of goodness. Finkel McGraw detached himself from the railing and began to walk along the river, keeping a brisk pace for a man of his age.
"I dare say that you shall make a prized addition to our file, which, as brilliantly as it shines in the fields of commerce and science, wants more artists."
Not wanting to join in criticism of the tribe he'd just sworn a solemn oath to uphold, Carl pursed his lips and mulled over some possible responses. Finkel McGraw continued,
"Do you suppose that we fail to encourage our own children to pursue the arts, or fail to attract enough men such as yourself, or perhaps both? With all due respect, Your Grace, I do not necessarily agree with your premise. New Atlantis has many fine artists." "Oh, come now. Why do all of them come from outside the tribe as you did? Really, Mr. Hollywood, would you have taken the oath at all if your prominence as a theatrical producer had not made it advantageous for you to do so?"
"I think I will choose to interpret your question as part of a Socratic dialogue for my edification," Carl Hollywood said carefully, "and not as an allegation of insincerity on my part. As a matter of fact, just before I encountered you, I was enjoying my cigar and looking about at London and thinking about just how well it all suits me."
"It suits you well because you are of a certain age now. You are a successful and established artist. The ragged bohemian life holds no charm for you anymore.
But would you have reached your current position if you had not lived that life when you were younger?
Now that you put it that way, Carl said, I agree that we might try to make some provision in the future for young Bohemians.
It wouldn't work, Finkel McGraw said. I've been thinking about this for years. I had the same idea, set up a sort of young artistic Bohemian theme park, sprinkled around in all the major cities where young New Atlantans who were so inclined could congregate and be subversive when they were in the mood. The whole idea was self-contradictory. Mr. Hollywood, I've devoted much effort during the last decade or so to the systematic encouragement of subversiveness.
You have? Are you not concerned that our young subversives will migrate to other files?
If Carl Hollywood could have kicked himself in the arse, he would have done so as soon as finishing that sentence. He had forgotten about Elizabeth Finkel McGraw's recent and highly publicized defection to Cryptnet. But the Duke took it serenely.
Some of them will, as the case of my granddaughter demonstrates. But what does it really mean when such a young person moves to another file?
It means that they have outgrown youthful credulity and no longer wish to belong to a tribe simply because it is the path of least resistance. They have developed principles. They are concerned with their personal integrity. It means, in short, that they are ripe to become members in good standing of New Atlantis, as soon as they develop the wisdom to see that it is, in the end, the best of all possible tribes.
Your strategy was much too subtle for me to follow, Carl said. I thank you for explaining it. You encourage subversiveness because you think that it will have an effect opposite to what one might naively suppose.
Yes. And that's the whole point of being an equity lord. You know, to look after the interests of the society as a whole instead of flogging one's own company or whatever. At any rate, this brings us to the subject of the advertisement I placed in the reactive sections of the Times and our consequent cinephone conversation.
Yes, Carl Hollywood said. You are looking for rectors who performed in a project called The Young Ladies Illustrated Prima.
The primer was my idea. I commissioned it. I paid the acting fees. Of course, owing to the way the media system is organized, I had no way to determine the identity of the actors to whom I was sending the fees, hence the need for a public advertisement.
Your Grace, I should tell you immediately, and would have told you on the cinephone had you not insisted that we defer all substantive discussion to a face-to-face, that I myself did not act in the Prima. A friend of mine did. When I saw the advertisement, I undertook to respond on her behalf. I understand that raptors are frequently pursued by overly appreciative members of their audience, said Finkel McGraw. And so I suppose I understand why you have chosen to act as intermediary in this case. Let me assure you that my motives are perfectly benign.